necessary to gain if I did not want to suffer many annoyances. And being treated as their master's equal, I was obliged to treat his servants accordingly, and even to do more for them than anyone else, because, in fact, I had much greater need of their services. Where there are only few servants, this is not a matter of such importance, but in the houses at which I visited, they were very numerous, all very uppish, great rascals, and keenly alive to their own interests. And the rascals knew how to manage so that I needed the services of each of them in turn. The women of Paris, with all their wit and intelligence, are entirely wrong in their ideas upon this point, and in their anxiety to save my purse, they ruined me. If I went out to supper a little distance from home, instead of letting me send for a coach, the lady of the house ordered her horses to be put to drive me back. She was delighted to spare me the expense of the carriage, 24 sous, but she never thought of the crown which I gave the footman and coachman. If a lady wrote to me from Paris to the Hermitage or Montmorency, in order to spare me the 4 sous for postage, she sent the letter by one of her servants, who made the journey on foot, and arrived bathed in perspiration, and I had to give him a crown and a dinner, which he had certainly well earned. If she invited me to stay a week or a fortnight at her country house, she said to herself, "Anyhow, it will be a saving for the poor fellow. He will not have to pay for his food while he's here." She forgot that during that time I did no work, that my rent, household expenses, washing and clothes still had to be paid for, that it cost me twice as much for my barber, and that it was more expensive for me to live in her house than at home. Although I limited my trifling gratuities to the houses in which I was in the habit of staying, they were nonetheless ruinous to me. I am convinced that it cost me more than 25 crowns at Madame Doudetot's house at Aubonne, where I only slept 4 or 5 times, and more than 100 pistoles at Epinay and La Chevrette, during the 5 or 6 years in which I was a constant visitor there. These expenses are unavoidable for a man of my disposition, who does not know how to do anything for himself, or to set his wits to work upon anything, who cannot endure the sight of a lackey who grumbles and performs his duties sulkily. Even at Madame Dupin's, where I was one of the family, and where I rendered many services to the servants, I never received any from them unless I paid for them on the nail. À la pointe de mon argent, literally, I never received any from them except at the point of my money. Subsequently, I was obliged altogether to discontinue these trifling gratuities, which my position no longer allowed me to give. And then it was that I felt even more keenly the disadvantage of associating with persons in a different station of life to one's own. Again, if this life had been to my taste, I should have felt consoled for the heavy expenditure on my pleasures, but I could not endure to ruin myself simply for the sake of becoming utterly wearied. And I had felt so strongly the burden of this manner of life that, taking advantage of the interval of freedom which I then enjoyed, I determined to make it lasting, to renounce fashionable and literary society altogether, to give up writing books, and to confine myself for the remainder of my days to the limited and peaceful sphere for which I felt that I was born. The profits of the Lettre de D'Alembert and the new Héloïse had somewhat improved the state of my finances, which had been almost exhausted at the Hermitage. I saw about 1,000 crowns in prospect. Emile, to which I seriously began to devote my attention after I had finished Héloïse, was well advanced, and I expected that its profits would at least double that sum. I formed the resolution of investing this fund in such a manner as to bring me in a small annuity, which, together with my copying, would be sufficient to keep me without writing any more. I still had 2 works in hand. The first was my Institution Politique. I examined the state of this work, and found that it would still require several years of labour. I had not the courage to continue it and to wait until it was finished before carrying out my resolution. I accordingly abandoned it, and decided to extract what was possible, and to burn the rest. And, pushing on this work vigorously, without discontinuing Emile, in less than 2 years I put the finishing touch to the Contrat Social. There still remained the Dictionnaire de Musique. This was a purely mechanical work, which could be taken up at any time, and which I had undertaken merely for the sake of the money. I reserved to myself the right of abandoning it, or finishing it at my leisure, according as my other combined resources might render it necessary or superfluous. In regard to the morale sensitive, of which I had only made an outline, I abandoned it altogether. As my last intention, if I could dispense with copying altogether, was to remove to a distance from Paris, where the constant stream of visitors made it expensive for me to live, and deprive me of the time to make provision for myself, I kept in reserve, in order to prevent in my retirement the feeling of weariness, which is said to come upon an author when he's laid down his pen, an occupation which might fill up the void in my solitude, without leading me into the temptation of publishing anything more during my lifetime. I do not know what whim had prompted Ray, for a long time past, to urge me to write the memoirs of my life, although as far as incidents were concerned, they were not at that time particularly interesting. I felt that they might be made so by the candour with which I was capable of treating the subject, and I was determined to make it a work unique of its kind by an unexampled veracity, which, for once at least, would enable the outside world to behold a man as he really was in his inmost self. I had always ridiculed the false ingenuousness of Montaigne, who, while pretending to confess his defects, is most careful to attribute to himself only such as are amiable, whereas I, who have always believed, and still believe, myself to be, all things considered, the best of men, felt that there is no human heart, however pure it may be, which does not conceal some odious vice. I knew that I was represented in the world under features so utterly different from my own, and sometimes so distorted, that in spite of my defects, none of which I had the least desire to conceal, I could not help being the gainer by showing myself in my true character. Besides, this was impossible without also showing others as they were, and consequently this work could not be published until after my own death, and that of several others. This further emboldened me to write my confessions, for which I shall never have to blush before anybody. I accordingly determined to devote my leisure to carrying out this undertaking, and I commenced to collect the letters and papers which might guide or assist my memory, greatly regretting all that I had torn up, burned, or lost up to this time. This project of complete retirement, one of the most sensible that I'd ever formed, made a very strong impression on my mind, and I had already commenced to carry it out, when heaven, which was preparing a different destiny for me, flung me into a fresh whirl of excitement. Montmorency, the ancient and splendid patrimony of the family of that name, has been confiscated and no longer belongs to it. Through the sister of Duke Henri, it has passed to the house of Condé, which has changed the name of Montmorency to Enghien, and the duchy has no other chateau except an old tower, in which the archives are kept, and where the vassals come to render homage. But at Montmorency, or Enghien, may be seen a private house built by Croisset, called Le Pauvre, which, equal in magnificence to the most superb chateau, deserves and bears the name of one. The imposing aspect of this fine building, the terrace upon which it stands, the view from it, which is perhaps unequalled in the world, its spacious salon, painted by a master hand, its garden, laid out by the celebrated Le Nostre, all this forms a whole, the striking majesty of which nevertheless presents a certain simplicity, which arouses a lasting admiration. Monsieur le Maréchal, Duc de Luxembourg, who at that time occupied the house, came twice every year into the district where his forefathers had formerly been masters, to spend 5 or 6 weeks as an ordinary inhabitant, but in great style, which in no way fell short of the old magnificence of his house. The first time he visited it, after he had settled at Montmorency, Monsieur and Madame la Maréchale sent their compliments to me by a footman, and an invitation to sup with them whenever I pleased. Each time that they came again, they never failed to repeat their compliments and invitation. This reminded me of Madame de Beauvanzel sending me to dine in the servants' hall. Times were changed, but I was still the same. I had no desire to be sent to dine in the servants' hall, and I cared but little for the tables of the great. I should have preferred that they'd left me for what I was, without making much of or humiliating me. I replied to Monsieur Madame de Luxembourg's civilities politely and respectfully, but I did not accept their invitations. My ill health, as much as a natural shyness and awkwardness in conversation, made me shudder at the mere idea of presenting myself before an assembly of court grandees, and I did not even go to the chateau to pay a complimentary visit of thanks, although I understood well enough that this was what they wanted, and that all their eagerness was due to curiosity more than goodwill. Nevertheless, they continued to make advances, and even with greater persistency. Madame la Comtesse de Boufflers, who was very intimate with Madame la Maréchale, had come to Montmorency. She sent to inquire after me and asked whether she might pay me a visit. I replied politely, but did not stir. During the Easter visit of the following year, 1759, the Chevalier de Lorenzi, who belonged to the suite of Monsieur le Prince de Conti, and to Madame de Luxembourg's circle, came to visit me several times. We became acquainted. He pressed me to go to the chateau. I refused. At last, one afternoon, when I least expected it, I saw Monsieur le Maréchal de Luxembourg approaching, attended by five or six persons. There no longer remained any means of escape, and I could not, without being considered arrogant and ill-bred, avoid returning his visit, and paying my respects to Madame la Maréchale, on the part of whom he overwhelmed me with polite messages. Thus commenced, under fatal auspices, a connection which I could no longer escape, but which a presentiment, only too well-founded, made me dread, until I found myself committed to it. I was terribly afraid of Madame de Luxembourg. I knew that she was amiable. I had seen her several times at the theatre, and at Madame Dupin's 10 or 12 years ago, when she was Duchesse de Boufflers, and was still in the first brilliancy of her beauty. But she had the reputation of being spiteful, and this, in so great a lady, made me tremble. No sooner did I see her than I was vanquished. I found her charming, with that charm which is proof against time, and is most calculated to act upon my heart. I expected to find her conversation sarcastic and full of epigrams. This was not the case. It was something far better. Her conversation does not sparkle with wit. It exhibits no flights of fancy, or even, properly speaking, finesse. But it is marked by an exquisite refinement, which is never striking, but is always pleasing. Her flatteries are the more intoxicating in proportion to their simplicity. It seems as if they fall from her lips without thinking, and are the overflowings of a heart which is too full. I fancied that I perceived, at my first visit, that in spite of my awkward manner and clumsy phrases, she found my society agreeable. All court ladies know how to produce this impression whenever they please, whether it be true or not, but all do not know, as Madame de Luxembourg did, how to produce it in so charming a manner that one no longer thinks of doubting it. From the first day my confidence in her would have been as complete as it soon afterwards became, had not Madame la Duchesse de Montmorency, her daughter-in-law, a somewhat spiteful and, as I believe, quarrelsome young fool, taken it into her head to attack me, and in the midst of all her mamma's civilities and her own coquetries, made me suspect that they were only laughing at me. I should perhaps have found it difficult to make myself easy in regard to this apprehension in the case of the two ladies, had not the very great kindness of Monsieur le Maréchal convinced me that theirs also was genuine. Considering my timid disposition, nothing is more surprising than the readiness with which I took him at his word as to the footing of equality on which he wanted to put himself with me, except perhaps the equal readiness with which he himself took my word as to the complete independence in which I wanted to live. Convinced that I was right to be satisfied with my position and not to desire any change in it, neither he nor Madame de Luxembourg appeared for a moment to trouble themselves about my purse or my means. Although I could not doubt the warm interest which they both took in me, They never offered to find me a place, or to assist me with their influence. Except once, when Madame de Luxembourg seemed desirous that I should enter the Académie Française. I raised the objection of my religious faith. She said that that was no obstacle, or that, if it was one, she would undertake to remove it. I replied that in spite of the great honour I should consider it, to be a member of so illustrious a body, as I had refused the invitation of Monsieur de Tressin, and, in a manner, of the King of Poland, to enter the Académie of Nancy, I could not with propriety become a member of any other. Madame de Luxembourg did not press the matter further, and nothing more was said about it. The simplicity of intercourse with such great people, who could have done anything for me, since Monsieur de Luxembourg was, and deserved to be, the special friend of the King, is in singular contrast with the continual fussiness, as troublesome as it was officious, of the patronizing friends I'd just left, and whose object was rather to humiliate than to serve me. When Monsieur le Maréchal had visited me at Mont-Louis, I had received him and his suite in my own room with a feeling of embarrassment, not because I was obliged to ask him to sit down in the middle of my dirty plates and broken jugs, but because my floor was rotten and falling to pieces, and I was afraid that the weight of his suite might make it give way altogether. Thinking less of my own danger than of that to which this worthy gentleman's affability exposed him, I hastened to get him out of it by taking him, in spite of the weather, which was still very cold, to my tower, which was completely exposed and had no fireplace. When we were there, I told him the reason why I'd brought him. He repeated it to Madame la Maréchale, and both pressed me to stay at the chateau until the floor had been repaired, or, if I preferred, at a detached building in the middle of the park, which was called the Little Chateau. This enchanted abode deserves special mention. The park, or garden, of Montmorency is not on a level, like that of La Chevrette. It is uneven, hilly, with alternate elevations and depressions, which the clever artist has taken advantage of to give variety to the groves, waters, decorations, and different views, and to multiply, so to speak, with the aid of genius and art, a space which in itself is somewhat confined. This park is crowned at the top by the terrace and the chateau. At the bottom it forms a ravine, which opens and widens in the direction of the valley, the angle of which is filled by a large sheet of water. Between the orangery, which occupies this enlarged space, and this sheet of water, surrounded by elevations adorned with groves and trees, is the little chateau of which I have spoken. This building and the ground which surrounds it formerly belonged to the celebrated Lebrun, who amused himself with building and ornamenting it with exquisite taste in architecture and decoration, which this great painter had made his own. Lebrun was a celebrated French painter, 1619 to 1690. Since then this chateau has been rebuilt, but after its first owner's designs. It is small, simple, but elegant, as it lies between the basin of the orangery and the large sheet of water, and is consequently exposed to the damp. It has been pierced in the middle by an open peristyle between two rows of columns, so that the air blowing through the whole building keeps it dry, notwithstanding its situation. On looking at this building from the opposite height in perspective, it appears completely surrounded by water, like an enchanted island, or the most beautiful of the three Borromean islands, Isola Bella, in Lago Maggiore. In this solitary building I was offered the choice of one of the four complete apartments, which it contains, in addition to the ground floor, which consists of a ballroom, a billiard room, and a kitchen. I chose the smallest and simplest, above the kitchen, which I had as well. It was delightfully neat, with furniture in blue and white. In this profound and delightful solitude, in the midst of woods and waters, to the accompaniment of the songs of birds of every kind, surrounded by the perfumes of orange blossoms, I composed, in a continued state of ecstasy, the fifth book of Émile, the fresh colouring of which is in great part due to the lively impression of the locality in which I wrote. How eagerly I ran every morning at sunrise to breathe the perfumed air of the peristyle! What delicious café au lait I took there with my Thérèse! My cat and dog kept us company. This retinue alone would have been enough for my whole life. I should never have experienced a moment's weariness. I was in an earthly paradise. I lived there in the same state of innocence and enjoyed the same happiness. During their July visit, Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg showed me so many attentions and treated me with such kindness that, living in their house and overwhelmed by their civilities, I could not do less than repay it by visiting them frequently. I hardly left them at all. In the morning I went to pay my respects to Madame la Maréchale. After dining there, I took a walk in the afternoon with Monsieur le Maréchal. But I did not stay to supper, at which a number of great persons were always present. Besides, they supped too late for me. Up to this time all went on without a hitch, and no harm would have resulted, if I'd known how to leave things alone. But I have never been able to preserve a mean in my friendships, and simply to fulfil the duties of society. I've always been everything or nothing. Soon I was everything, and finding myself made much of and spoiled by people of such importance, I overstepped the proper limits, and conceived for them a friendship which it is only allowable to feel towards one's equals. I showed it by the familiarity which I assumed in my manners, while they, on their part, never abandoned the politeness to which they'd accustomed me. Yet I never felt quite at ease with Madame la Maréchale. Although not completely reassured as to her character, I feared it less than her wit, of which I particularly stood in awe. I knew that she was difficult to satisfy in conversation, and that she had the right to be so. I knew that women, especially great ladies, must be amused, and that it is better to offend them than to bore them. And I judged, from her remarks upon the conversation of the people who had just taken leave of her, what she must have thought of my silly nonsense. I thought of an expedient to save myself from the embarrassment of talking to her. This was to read to her. She had heard Julie spoken of. She knew that it was being printed. She showed an eagerness to see the work. I offered to read it to her, and she consented. I went to her every morning at 10 o'clock. Monsieur de Luxembourg came, and the door was shut. I read by the side of her bed, and portioned out my readings so well that they would have lasted throughout her stay, even if it had not been interrupted. The loss of a great battle, which greatly afflicted the king, obliged Monsieur de Luxembourg to return suddenly to court. The success of this expedient surpassed my expectations. Madame de Luxembourg took a violent fancy to Julie and its author. She spoke of nothing but me, thought of nothing but me, flattered me the whole of the day, and embraced me 10 times a day. She insisted that I should always sit by her at table, and when any great noblemen wanted to take this place, she told them that it belonged to me, and made them sit somewhere else. It is easy to imagine the impression which these charming manners produced upon me, who am subjugated by the slightest marks of affection. I became sincerely attached to her, in proportion to the attachment which she showed for me. My only fear when I perceived this infatuation was that, as I felt I was not sufficiently agreeable to keep it alive, it might change to disgust. And unfortunately for me, this fear was only too well founded. There must have been a natural opposition between her turn of mind and my own, since, independently of the many stupid and injudicious remarks which every moment escaped me in the course of conversation, and even in my letters, and when I was on the best of terms with her, there were certain things which displeased her, without my being able to imagine the reason. I will only mention one instance out of 20. She knew that I was making a copy of Héloïse for Madame Dudetot, at so much a page. She wanted me to make one for her on the same terms. I promised to do so, and consequently, entering her name as one of my customers, I wrote her a few lines of polite thanks, or at least I had intended them as such. I received the following answer, which utterly astonished me. Packet C, number 43. Versailles, Tuesday. I am delighted, I am satisfied. Your letter has given me infinite pleasure. I hasten to inform you, and to thank you for it. Here are the exact words of your letter. Although you are certainly a very good customer, I feel some difficulty about taking your money. Properly speaking, I ought to pay for the pleasure of being permitted to work for you. I will not mention the subject again. I regret that you do not tell me more about the state of your health. Nothing interests me more. I love you with all my heart, and I assure you it is with great sorrow that I write this to you, for it would be a great pleasure to me to tell it to you by word of mouth. Monsieur de Luxembourg loves you and embraces you in all sincerity. On receiving this letter, I hastened to reply to it before examining it more fully. In order to protest against any impolite interpretation, and after having devoted several days to this examination, with a feeling of uneasiness which may be imagined, without being able to understand what was the matter, I wrote the following note as a final answer on the subject. Montmorency, December 8, 1759. Since writing my letter, I have examined the passage in question hundreds and hundreds of times. I have considered it in its own natural meaning. I have considered it in every meaning that could be put upon it. And I confess, Madame la Maréchale, that I am at a loss to know whether it is I who owe you excuses, or whether it is not rather yourself who owe them to me. It is now 10 years since these letters were written. I have often thought of them since then, and even to this day I am so stupid on this point that I have not been able to understand what she could find in the passage in question that was, I will not say offensive, but even calculated to cause her displeasure. In reference to this manuscript of Héloïse, which Madame de Luxembourg wanted to have, I ought to mention here what I had intended to do, in order to give it some special distinction above all the rest. I had written the adventures of Lord Edward separately, and I had long been undecided whether I should insert them, either wholly or in extracts, in this work, in which they seemed to me to be out of place. I finally decided to cut them out altogether, because, not being in keeping with the tone of the remainder, they would have spoiled its touching simplicity. I had a weightier reason when I made the acquaintance of Madame de Luxembourg. In these adventures there was a Roman marchioness of very odious character, some features of which, without being applicable to her, might perhaps have been applied to her by those who only knew her by reputation. I therefore congratulated myself upon the resolution I had taken, and determined to keep to it. But, being extremely desirous of enriching her copy with something which was not contained in any others, I was misguided enough to think of these unfortunate adventures, and I formed the plan of making a selection of them and adding it to the work. A mad project, the extravagance of which can only be explained by the blind fatality which was dragging me to my destruction. Quos vult perdere, Jupiter dementat. Those whom he wishes to lose, Jupiter drives mad. I was foolish enough to make this extract with great care and labour, and to send it to her as if it had been the most beautiful thing in the world, at the same time informing her, as was true, that I had burnt the original, that the extract was intended for her alone, and would never be seen by anybody, unless she herself showed it. And this action on my part, far from proving to her my prudence and discretion, as I expected, only gave her an idea of the opinion which I myself held, as to the application of the features of the work, by which she might have felt offended. My imbecility was so great that I entertained no doubt that she would be enchanted by what I had done. She did not compliment me upon it as heartily as I expected, and to my very great surprise never spoke to me of the manuscript which I had sent her. I myself, delighted with my conduct in the matter, did not suspect till long afterwards, in consequence of other indications, the effect which it had produced. In regard to her manuscript, I had another idea, which was more sensible, but which, in its remoter effects, was almost equally prejudicial to me. So greatly does everything assist the work of destiny when it summons a man to misfortune. I thought of ornamenting this manuscript with the drawings of the engravings of Julie, which were of the same size as the manuscript. I asked Coindé for the drawings, to which I had every possible claim, the more so as I had allowed him the profits of the plates, which had a large sale. Grandet is as cunning as I am the reverse. My repeated requests for them at last made him understand for what purpose I wanted them. Then, under pretence of improving them, he induced me to leave them with him, and finally presented them himself. Ego versiculos feci tulit alta honores. This introduced him to the Hotel de Luxembourg and gave him a certain footing in it. After my removal to the little chateau, he frequently came to see me, and always in the morning, especially when Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg were at Montmorency. The consequence was that, in order to spend the day with him, I did not go to the chateau at all. I was reproached for these absences. I explained the reason. I was pressed to take Monsieur Condé with me. I did so. This was just what the rascal had been scheming for. Thus, thanks to the extraordinary kindness with which I was treated, Monsieur Telluçon's clerk, who was sometimes invited to dine with his master when there were no other guests, suddenly found himself admitted to the table of a Marshal of France, and the company of princes, duchesses, and the highest personages of the court. I shall never forget that one day, when he was obliged to return to Paris early, Monsieur le Maréchal said to the company after dinner, "Let us walk along the road to Saint-Denis, then we can give Monsieur Coindet our company." The poor fellow could not stand it. He lost his head completely. As for me, I felt so affected that I could not utter a word. I followed behind, weeping like a child, and longing to kiss the footprints of this good Maréchal. But the continuation of the history of this manuscript has made me anticipate events. Let me now take them up in their proper order, as far as my memory will allow me. As soon as the little house at Mont-Louis was ready, I furnished it, neatly and simply, and returned there to live, being unable to renounce the determination to which I had come when I left the Hermitage, namely, always to live in a place of my own. But neither could I make up my mind to give up my apartment in the little chateau. I kept the key of it, and in my fondness for the nice little breakfasts in the peristyle, I often slept there, and sometimes spent 2 or 3 days, as if it had been my country house. I perhaps had more comfortable and agreeable apartments at that time than any private individual in Europe. My landlord, Monsieur Mata, who was the best fellow in the world, had left me the complete control of the repairs of Mont-Louis, and insisted that I should make use of his workmen as I pleased, without any interference on his part. I found means to make a complete suite of apartments out of a single room on the first floor, consisting of a bedroom, an antechamber, and a wardrobe. On the ground floor were the kitchen and Thérèse's room. The turret served as a study, after a glazed partition and a fireplace had been added. When I was there, I amused myself with decorating the terrace, which was already shaded by 2 rows of young lime trees. I planted 2 more rows in order to make a regular arbour. I had a table and some stone benches put there. I surrounded it with lilac, syringa, and honeysuckle. I had a pretty border of flowers laid out, parallel to the 2 rows of trees. And this terrace, which was higher than that of the chateau, from which the view was at least as fine, and which was inhabited by a number of birds which I had tamed, served me as a kind of reception room when I had company, such as Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg, Monsieur le Duc de Villeroy, Monsieur le Prince de Tingry, Monsieur le Marquis d'Armentières, Madame la Duchesse de Montmorency, Madame la Duchesse de Boufflers, Madame la Comtesse de Valentinois, Madame la Comtesse de Boufflers, and other persons of similar rank, who condescended to undertake, by a very fatiguing climb, the pilgrimage from the chateau to Mont-Louis. I owed the compliment of all these visits to Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg. I was sensible of this, and my heart rendered them the homage of gratitude. It was in one of my transports of emotion that I said to Monsieur de Luxembourg, "Ah, Monsieur le Maréchal, I used to hate the great before I knew you, and I hate them still more since you have made me feel how easy it would be for them to make themselves adored." More than this, I put the question to all those who knew me during this period, whether they have ever observed that this brilliancy has dazzled me for a single moment, that the fumes of this incense have mounted to my head, whether they have seen me less uniform in my conduct, less simple in my manners, less affable towards the people, less familiar with my neighbours, less ready to assist everyone when I have had the power, without ever being offended by the numberless and frequently unreasonable importunities with which I was incessantly overwhelmed. If my heart drew me towards the Chateau of Montmorency, owing to my sincere attachment for its owners, it brought me back in the same manner to my own neighbourhood, to taste the sweets of that even and simple life, outside which there is no happiness for me. Thérèse had formed a friendship with the daughter of one of my neighbours, a bricklayer, named Pileur. I did the same with the father, and after having lunched at the chateau in the morning, not without some unwillingness, in order to please Madame la Maréchale, I eagerly returned in the evening to sup with the worthy Pileur and his family, sometimes at his house, sometimes at mine. Besides these two lodgings, I soon had a third at the Hôtel de Luxembourg, the owners of which pressed me so earnestly to go and see them sometimes, that I agreed, in spite of my aversion to Paris, where I had only been on the two occasions I have mentioned, after my retirement to the Hermitage. Even then I only went on days that had been agreed upon beforehand, simply to supper, and returned the following morning. I entered and left by the garden adjoining the boulevard, so that I was enabled to say, with strict truth, that I had never set foot upon the pavement of Paris. In the midst of this temporary prosperity, the catastrophe which was to mark the end of it was preparing in the distance. Shortly after my return to Mont-Louis, I made, in spite of myself as usual, a new acquaintance, which also marks an epoch in my history, whether for good or evil will be afterwards seen. I refer to my neighbour, the Marquise de Verdelin, whose husband had just bought a country house at Soissy, near Montmorency. Mademoiselle d'Ar, daughter of the Comte d'Ar, a man of position but poor, had married Monsieur de Verdelin, old, ugly, deaf, harsh, brutal, jealous, covered with scars and one-eyed. In other respects a good sort of fellow, when one knew how to take him, and possessed of an income of 15,000 to 20,000 livres, to which his wife's parents married her. This paragon of amiability, who swore, shouted, grumbled, stormed, and made his wife cry all day long, always ended by doing what she wanted, with the idea of putting her in a rage, seeing that she knew how to make him believe that it was he, and not she, who wanted it done. Monsieur de Margency, of whom I have spoken, was Madame's friend, and became her husband's. Some years ago he had let to them his chateau of Margency, near Aubon and Ardilly, where they were living just at the time of my amour with Madame Dudateau. Madame de Verdelin and the latter had made each other's acquaintance through their mutual friend, Madame d'Aubeterre. As the gardener Margency was on the road which Madame Dudateau had to take to get to Mont Olympe, her favourite walk, Madame de Verdelin gave her a key, that she might go through the garden. Thanks to this key, I often went with her. But I was not fond of unexpected meetings, and when Madame de Verdelin happened to meet us, I left them together without saying a word, and walked on. This ungallant behaviour on my part could not have given her a very favourable impression of me. However, when she was at Soissy, she nevertheless sought my society. She came to see me several times at Mont-Louis, without finding me at home, and as I did not return her visit, she bethought herself of sending me some pots of flowers for my terrace, in order to force me to do so. I was obliged to go and thank her. That was enough, the acquaintance was made. This connection was stormy at first, like all those which I made in spite of myself. It was never even really peaceful. Madame de Verdelin's turn of mind was too antipathetic to my own. She utters spiteful and epigrammatic remarks with such an air of simplicity that it requires the closest attention, which is very fatiguing to me, to know when she is laughing at anybody. One instance of her silliness, which I remember, will be enough to give an idea of her manner. Her brother had just been appointed to the command of a frigate, which was starting on a cruise against the English. I was speaking of the manner in which this frigate had been armed, without any injury to its speed. Yes, said she, without changing her tone, only as many cannon are taken as are wanted for fighting. I have rarely heard her say anything good of any of her absent friends, without slipping in something against them. What she did not put a bad construction upon, she turned into ridicule. Her friend Margency was not accepted. Another thing which I found unendurable was the continual nuisance of her little messages, presents, and notes, which I was obliged to rack my brains to know how to answer, and which were always a source of fresh embarrassment, whether I had to write a letter of thanks or a refusal. However, from continually seeing her, I at last became attached to her. She, like myself, had her sorrows. Our mutual confidences made our tête-à-têtes interesting. Nothing unites hearts so much as the pleasure of shedding tears together. We sought each other's society in order to console ourselves, and the need for this made me overlook much. I had shown such roughness in my outspokenness to her, and had sometimes shown so little respect for her character, that I really must have felt a great deal to believe that she could sincerely pardon me. The following is a sample of the letters which I sometimes wrote to her, in regard to which it is worthy of notice that she never, in any of her answers, showed the least sign of annoyance. Montmorency, November 5, 1760. You inform me, madame, that you have not expressed yourself very well, in order to give me to understand that I have expressed myself very badly. You speak of your pretended stupidity, in order to make me sensible of my own. You boast of being nothing more than a good woman, as if you were afraid of being taken at your word, and you make excuses to me in order to make me feel that I owe you some in return. Yes, madame, I know it well. It is I who am a fool, a good man, and worse still, if it is possible. It is I who do not choose my terms sufficiently well to please a fine French lady, who pays as much attention to phrases and speaks as well as you do. But you must consider that I take them in the ordinary meaning of the language, without being familiar with the polite acceptations which are sometimes attached to them in the virtuous society of Paris. If my expressions are sometimes ambiguous, I endeavour by my conduct to give them a definite meaning, etc. The remainder of the letter is after the same style. Her answer, Packet D, number 41, will give an idea of the incredible self-restraint of a woman's heart, who can feel no greater resentment against such a letter than is shown in her reply, and than she herself has exhibited towards me. Quande, bold and daring to the verge of effrontery, who was ever lying in wait for my friends, was not slow to introduce himself to Madame de Verdelin's in my name, and soon became, unknown to me, more intimate there than myself. This Quande was a queer fellow. He introduced himself from me to all my acquaintances, made himself at home, and took his meals with them without ceremony. In his devoted zeal for me he never spoke of me, except with tears in his eyes. But when he came to see me he preserved the most profound silence about all these connections, and everything in which he knew I must feel interested. Instead of telling me what he had heard, said, or seen, which was of interest to me, he listened to me, and even asked me questions. He never knew anything about Paris except what I told him. In short, although everyone spoke to me of him, he never spoke to me of anybody. He was only close and mysterious with his friend. But let us leave Quande and Madame de Verdelin for the present. We will return to them later. Some time after my return to Montlouis, Latour, the painter, came to see me and brought me my portrait in pastel, which he had exhibited some years before at the Salon. He had wanted to make me a present of it, but I had refused it. Madame d'Épinay, who had given me hers and wanted mine, had made me promise to ask him for it back. He had taken some time to touch it up. In the meantime, my rupture with Madame d'Épinay occurred. I gave her back her portrait, and, as I could no longer think of giving her mine, I hung it up in my room in the little chateau. Monsieur de Luxembourg saw it there, and took a fancy to it. I offered it to him, he accepted it, and I sent it to him. He and Madame la Maréchale understood that I should be very pleased to have theirs. They had them taken in miniature by a very clever artist, and set in a sweetmeat box of rock crystal, mounted in gold, which they presented to me in a most handsome manner, with which I was delighted. Madame de Luxembourg would never consent that her portrait should be on the upper part of the box. She had several times reproached me with being fonder of the marshal than of herself, and I had not denied it because it was true. She proved to me very politely, but at the same time very cleverly, by this manner of placing her portrait, that she did not forget my preference. About the same time I was guilty of an act of folly, which did not help to keep me in her good graces. Although I had no acquaintance with Monsieur de Silhouette, the Controller General of Finance in 1757, and was little inclined to like him, I had a great opinion of his administrative powers. When he began to lay a heavy hand upon the financiers, I saw that he was not commencing the operation at a favourable moment. Nevertheless, I wished him all success, and when I heard that he had been removed from office, I was so thoughtless as to write the following letter to him, which assuredly I do not attempt to justify. Montmorency, December 2, 1759. Condescend, sir, to accept the homage of a recluse who is unknown to you, but who esteems you for your talents, who respects you for your administration, and who has done you the honour of believing that it would not long remain in your hands. Unable to save the state, except at the expense of the capital which has destroyed it, you have dared to brave the outcries of the money-grubbers. When I saw how you crushed these wretches, I envied you your office. Now that I see how you have abandoned it without belying yourself, I admire you. Be satisfied with yourself, sir. You take with you from it an honour which you will long enjoy without a rival. The execrations of rascals are the glory of an upright man. 1760. Madame de Luxembourg, who knew that I had written this letter, spoke to me about it when she came out at Easter. I showed it to her. She wished for a copy, and I gave her one. But I did not know, when I did so, that she herself was one of those money-grubbers who had an interest in sub-leases, and had caused the removal of Silhouette. To judge from my numerous follies, it seemed as if I purposely wanted to arouse the hatred of an amiable and influential woman, to whom I was becoming more sincerely attached every day, and whose displeasure I was far from wishing to bring upon myself, although by my repeated acts of stupidity I was doing everything that was wanted to produce such a result. I think it is hardly necessary to mention that it is to her that the story of Monsieur Tronchard's opiate, of which I have spoken in the first part of my confessions, refers. The other lady was Madame de Mirepoix. Neither of them has ever mentioned it to me again, or appeared to have the slightest recollection of it. But I find it difficult, even if one did not know anything of subsequent events, to assume that Madame de Luxembourg can have rarely forgotten it. For my own part, I tried to reassure myself as to the effect of my follies by the evidence which I produced to myself, that none of them had been committed with the intention of offending her. As if a woman could ever pardon such follies, even though she is perfectly certain that they were not the result of deliberate intention. However, although she seemed to see and feel nothing, although I found no abatement in her warmth and no alteration in her manner towards me, a continually growing presentiment, which was only too well founded, made me tremble incessantly, for fear her infatuation for me might be succeeded by disgust. Could I expect, on the part of so great a lady, a constancy which would be proof against my lack of address to support it? I did not even know how to conceal from her this dim presentiment, which disquieted me, and only made me more sullen and awkward. This may be seen from the following letter, which contains a very singular prediction. Nota bene. This letter, which is undated in my rough copy, was written in October 1760, at the latest. How cruel your kindness is! Why disturb the tranquillity of a recluse who renounced the pleasures of life in order to feel the weariness of them no longer. I have spent my life in the vain endeavour to find lasting attachments. I have been unable to form any in the ranks which were accessible to me. Am I to look for them in yours? Neither interest nor ambition has any temptations for me. I have little vanity. I am rather timid. I can resist everything except affection. Why do you both attack me in a weakness which I must overcome, since, considering the distance which separates us, the overflowings of tender hearts cannot bring mine near to you? Will gratitude be sufficient for a heart which knows not two ways of bestowing itself, and only feels capable of friendship? Friendship, Madame la Maréchale. Ah, therein lies my misfortune. It is very handsome of you and Monsieur le Maréchal to use this term, but I am a fool to take you at your word. You are amusing yourselves. I am forming an attachment to you, and the end of the game has fresh sorrows in store for me. How I hate all your titles, and how I pity you for having them. You seem to me so worthy to taste the charms of private life. Why do you not live at Clarens? I would go there in search of the happiness of my life. But the Chateau of Montmorency, the Hôtel de Luxembourg, is that where one ought to see Jean-Jacques? Is that where a friend of equality, who, in thus paying for the esteem which is shown for him, believes that he is returning as much as he receives, ought to carry the affections of a tender heart? You are good and also feeling. I know it. I have seen it. I regret that I have not been able to believe it sooner. But considering the position which you hold and the manner in which you live, nothing can make a lasting impression upon you, and so many new interests efface each other that not one is permanent. You will forget me, madame, after you have made it impossible for me to imitate you. You will have done much to make me unhappy and unable to justify myself. I coupled Monsieur de Luxembourg's name with hers in order to make the compliment less harsh for her. Besides, I was so sure of him that I had never for a moment felt any anxiety as to the duration of his friendship. None of my apprehensions in regard to his wife ever extended to him. I have never felt the least mistrust of his character, which I knew was weak but trustworthy. I had no more fear of a coldness on his part than expectation of a heroic attachment. The simplicity and familiarity of our intercourse showed how each of us depended upon the other. We were both right. As long as I live, I shall honour and cherish the memory of this worthy gentleman. And whatever attempts may have been made to part him from me, I am as certain that he died my friend as if I had received his last sigh. During their second stay at Montmorency in 1760, having come to the end of Julie, I had recourse to Emile in order to keep in with Madame de Luxembourg, but this did not prove so successful, either because the subject was less to her taste, or because she was at last tired of so much reading. However, as she reproached me with allowing myself to be cheated by my publishers, she wanted me to leave the printing and publication of it to her, that she might make a better bargain. I accepted her proposal, expressly stipulating that the work should not be printed in France. We had a long dispute upon this point. I maintained that it was impossible to obtain, and even imprudent to ask for, tacit permission, and I would not hear of its being printed in the kingdom on any other terms, while she insisted that there would not be the least difficulty about the censorship under the system which had been adopted by the government. She found the means of bringing Monsieur de Malesherbes over to her views. He wrote me a long letter himself in order to prove that the profession de foi du vicaire Savoyard was just the kind of thing to meet with the approval of the human race everywhere, and under the circumstances even of the court. I was surprised to find this official, who was as a rule so timid, so easy-going in this matter. As his mere approval was enough to legalize the printing of a book, I could make no further objection. However, in consequence of a singular scruple, I still insisted that the work should be printed in Holland, and by Neholm, whom, not satisfied with mentioning him, I apprised of my intention, I agreed that the profits of the edition should go to a French publisher, and that when it was ready it should be sold in Paris or anywhere else, since the sale did not concern me. These were the exact terms of the agreement made by Madame de Luxembourg and myself, after which I handed over the manuscript to her. She had brought with her on this occasion her granddaughter, Mademoiselle de Boufflers, now Madame la Duchesse de Lauzun. Her name was Amélie. She was a charming person. Her face, gentleness, and timidity were truly maidenly. Nothing could have been more amiable or more interesting than her features, nothing tenderer or more chaste than the feelings which they inspired. Besides, she was a mere child, not yet 11 years of age. Madame la Maréchale, finding her too shy, did her best to rouse her. She several times allowed me to kiss her, which I did with my usual awkwardness. Instead of the pretty things which anyone else in my place would have said, I stood mute and utterly confused. I do not know which of us was the more bashful, the poor little one or myself. One day I met her alone on the staircase of the little chateau. She was coming to see Thérèse, with whom her governess still was. Not knowing what to say to her, I asked her to give me a kiss, which, in the innocence of her heart, she did not refuse, as she had already given me one that very morning, by her grandmamma's orders, and in her presence. The next day, while reading Émile at Madame la Maréchale's bedside, I came upon a passage in which I have justly censured the very thing that I had myself done the day before. She found the observation very just, and made some sensible remark upon it, which caused me to blush. How I curse my incredible stupidity, which has often caused me to appear vile and guilty, when I have only been foolish and embarrassed, a foolishness which is regarded as only a false excuse in the case of a man who is known to be not wanting in intelligence. I can swear that in this kiss, which was so blamable, as in all the rest, Mademoiselle Amélie's heart and feelings were no purer than my own. I can even swear that if at that moment I could have avoided meeting her, I would have done so, for although I was very pleased to see her, I was greatly at a loss to find something agreeable to say to her in passing. How is it that a child can intimidate a man whom the power of kings fails to alarm? What is a man to do? How is he to behave if he is utterly destitute of presence of mind? If I force myself to speak to people whom I meet, I infallibly utter some foolish remark. If I say nothing, then I am a misanthrope, a wild animal, a bear. Complete imbecility would have been far more favourable to me, but the talents which I lacked in society have made those which I possessed the instruments of my ruin. At the end of her stay on this occasion, Madame de Luxembourg carried out a good work, in which I had some share. Diderot had very rashly offended Madame la Princesse de Robec, a daughter of Monsieur de Luxembourg. Her protégé, Palissot, avenged her by the comedy of the Philosophe, in which I was held up to ridicule, and Diderot was very severely handled. The author was more merciful to me, not so much, I believe, on account of the obligations under which he was to me, as for fear of displeasing his patroness's father, who he knew entertained an affection for me. Duchesne, the bookseller, with whom I was not acquainted at the time, sent me the piece when it was printed, I suspect by Palissot's instructions, who perhaps thought that I should be glad to see a man pulled to pieces with whom I had broken off relations. He was greatly mistaken. When I broke with Diderot, whom I believed to be weak and indiscreet, rather than absolutely wicked, I still preserved in my heart a feeling of attachment, even of esteem for him, and of respect for our old friendship, which I am convinced was for a long time as sincere on his part as on my own. The case is quite different with Grimm, a man whose character is false, who never loved me, who is not even capable of loving, and who, with a light heart, without any reason for complaint, simply in order to satisfy his spiteful jealousy, has secretly become my bitterest calumniator. He is no longer anything to me. Diderot will always be my old friend. My tenderest feelings were moved at the sight of this hateful piece. I could not bear to read it, and without finishing it I sent it back to Duchesne, together with the following letter. Montmorency, May the 21st, 1760. Sir, on looking through the piece which you have sent me, I have shuddered at finding myself praised. I refuse to accept this horrible present. I am convinced that, in sending it to me, you did not intend to insult me. But you either do not know, or you have forgotten, that I have had the honour of being the friend of a man deserving of respect, who is unworthily traduced and calumniated in this libellous production. Duchesne handed this letter round. Diderot, who ought to have been touched by it, was annoyed. His amour-propre could not pardon me the superiority of a generous action, and I heard that his wife attacked me on every possible occasion, with a rage which affected me but little, since I knew that everybody looked upon her as a regular fish-fag. Diderot, in his turn, found an avenger in the Abbé Morellet, who wrote a little brochure against Palissot, after the manner of the Petit Prophète, called La Vision. In this pamphlet he very imprudently insulted Madame de Robec, whose friends caused him to be imprisoned in the Bastille. She herself was not of a sufficiently revengeful disposition, not to mention that at that time she was a dying woman, to have had anything to do with it. D'Alembert, who was very intimate with the Abbé Morellet, wrote and asked me to beg Madame de Luxembourg to procure his release, promising, in token of his gratitude,